The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today is from an ideas section entitled The Logical Endpoint of College Sports by Mark Novikoff. Cade Haskins averaged just 0.9 points a game this season for one of the worst teams in all of Division I college basketball. And yet he may turn out to be responsible for triggering one of the biggest changes in the sport's history. Last month, in a small HR office above the only sports bar in Hanover, New Hampshire, Haskins and his teammates on the Dartmouth College basketball squad voted to form the first ever NCAA Players Union. Their goal, to collectively bargain with the school for wages in exchange for playing basketball. Dartmouth had 6 wins and 21 losses this year, good enough for dead last in the Ivy League, itself not nationally competitive, and 334th out of the 362 Division I basketball teams. No player on the current roster was alive the last time Dartmouth had a winning season, and the program hasn't qualified for the March Madness tournament since 1959. The vote nonetheless drew reporters from national publications, including the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal, because of its potential to disrupt NCAA athletics. College sports generate billions of dollars in annual revenue, but the players putting on the show currently get nothing from that pot of money, even after a recent change allowing athletes to monetize their name, image, and likeness. They rely instead on advertisers, rich donors, and the pooled funds of loyal fans, who are themselves growing fatigued by propping it all up. The Dartmouth Players Union threatens to change that structure, opening the door for universities to pay college athletes directly. Some athletes could be in line for a huge windfall. The top college athletic departments generate more in sports revenue than some NHL teams. If Duke men's basketball players, for example, got the 50% share of the revenue common in professional sports, they'd be in line for $1.5 million each per year. If schools are going to compensate players directly, the NCAA would like to control how. The Dartmouth basketball players have put that future in doubt, replacing it with one where revenue-generating athletes sit across the table from schools, negotiating their cut, just like professionals. Historically, even the greatest college athletes made no money at all. They might receive cash or gifts under the table, but in doing so, they ran the risk of harsh punishment, no matter the size of the gift. In 2010, much of the Ohio State football team was suspended for nearly half a season for selling memorabilia in exchange for small amounts of cash, about $1,000, and discounted tattoos. That same season, the program generated roughly $52 million, of which the players got zero. The situation has changed radically, however, over the past 5 years. In 2019, California fired the first big shot, passing the Fair Pay to Play Act, allowing players to earn money from the use of their name, image, and likeness, NIL, as they would in endorsement deals. The law was set to take effect in 2023, but it never needed to, thanks to the Supreme Court's 2021 decision in NCAA versus Alston. In that case, the court unanimously ruled that the NCAA was violating antitrust law through strict rules governing the circumstances in which players could be compensated. Scholarships, but not internships, books, but not computers. According to the decision, by agreeing to not offer various benefits, universities were effectively conspiring to suppress the compensation of college athletes rather than competing to attract those athletes. 9 days after the ruling came out, the NCAA announced that it would allow players to make NIL deals regardless of whether they lived in the state that had passed a version of California's law. Since then, NIL has become a billion-dollar industry, with some players receiving big payouts in exchange for Nike shoe deals, Pringles ads on Instagram, and Google commercials on TV. These endorsements make up only a small fraction of NIL spending, most of which is done by collectives of alumni and fans who pool their money to recruit and retain top athletes, nominally as compensation for using the player's name, image, and likeness at, for example, a charity fundraiser. One such collective formed by the University of Texas football fans in 2021 announced it would pay offensive linemen at Texas $50,000 a year in an initiative it called the Pancake Factory, named for when an offensive lineman blocks a defender so hard that they're flattened like a pancake. Dartmouth players don't get lucrative NIL deals. Like all Ivy League athletes, they don't even get scholarships for being athletes. According to the college, the basketball team loses money for the school, and the players are aware that they aren't part of an economic juggernaut. They aren't demanding a piece of some billion-dollar pie that doesn't exist. As they told me and other journalists, they mostly just want the $16.25 an hour minimum wage paid to all student employees, including their own student managers. Basketball, they argue, is their campus job. According to Laura Sachs, the regional director of the National Labor Relations Board, who oversees much of New England, the basketball players are employees. As she put it in her ruling, allowing the unionization vote to proceed, the players perform work in exchange for compensation, rendering them employees by definition, even if the team, like any other number of businesses, loses money overall. The profitability of any given business does not affect the employee status of the individuals who perform work for that business, Sachs wrote. The work is lifting weights, playing basketball, occasionally skipping class, traveling many weekends, smoozing with alumni who might donate, and even avoiding taking classes in common periods that might conflict with practice. The compensation is expensive shoes, branded parkas, access to athletes-only gym, regular free meals, a laundry service for their jerseys. Then there's the greatest prize of all, access to what Sachs described as highly coveted admission spots for recruited players, which, for the less academically qualified athletes, translates to a dramatically better chance of getting accepted into an Ivy League school in the first place. Dartmouth disagrees with the characterization of the players as employees, and its legal team, which includes the former chair of the NLRB under Donald Trump, is appealing Sachs' decision. According to Dartmouth, athletes are just like any other student. If the basketball players are employees, the school argues, then it would be impossible to distinguish these student-athlete employees from other students at Dartmouth or any other university or college, or even those in high school, that are engaged in extracurricular activities that require their time, talents, skills, and efforts, and for which they receive no monetary compensation, but do receive university or activity branded apparel. Now is probably not a great time for Dartmouth to be arguing that players aren't workers. A small group of legal scholars have insisted for decades that the NCAA is an illegal cartel in which universities get together in private and set up the terms upon which they recruit, retain, and compensate talent without the talent present at the table. The Alston ruling, by holding that the NCAA isn't immune from antitrust law, opens the doors to a flood of lawsuits testing that theory. In February, a federal judge in Tennessee issued a preliminary injunction against the NCAA enforcing any rules surrounding NIL, which led the NCAA to announce that it would stop doing so. Meanwhile, a coalition of seven states is suing the NCAA over its rule requiring athletes who switch schools multiple times to sit out for a season before playing for their new team. The judge in that case has issued a preliminary injunction blocking the transfer policy from being enforced. The NCAA has signaled its openness to direct compensation of players, clinging to its right to make the rules even as that power gets stripped by the courts. The NCAA president, former Massachusetts Governor Charlie Baker, recently proposed a new subdivision of Division I schools that would pay at least $30,000 a year per eligible athlete into an educational trust fund. Schools would still have to vote on such a proposal, and it could take years to implement. But the NLRB ruling recognizing the Dartmouth Union, if it holds up on appeal, is poised to render those sorts of schemes moot. If players are employees, they must be paid, not through trust funds or NIL collectives, but rather actual wages or salaries from their employer, the university. As sports antitrust law professor Mark Edelman, who has studied this issue for years, told me, if the players are deemed to be employees, Dartmouth has to give at least the minimum wage. That's not even something that would be bargained for. The days of the NCAA unilaterally decreeing the terms of athletes' compensation appear to be numbered. So what comes next? The sports and entertainment law professor Michael McCann has observed that any school could just go ahead and start paying players now, giving itself a competitive advantage and daring the NCAA to try and stop it, knowing that the courts would likely rule on the school's side if push came to shove. Alternatively, athletic conferences could bargain with players. This is what union leaders at Dartmouth envision. In February, Cade Hoskins and his teammate Romeo Meyerthill announced that they would form an Ivy League Players Association to advocate for the interests of all Ivy League athletes. Hoskins told me that players in the top basketball conferences have reached out to him to see how the unionization effort has gone, perhaps a sign that players in bigger, better programs would be interested in this outcome as well. Or perhaps college sports will end up looking a lot more like professional sports landscape. In the major pro leagues, a players' union negotiates with owners on compensation rules, such as a minimum salary and a share of the overall revenue set aside for the players. This might be the most attractive option for college sports, because it doesn't put at risk the type of interconference tournaments that fans crave, like March Madness. The difference between college and pros is that, unlike in big-time professional leagues, most college athletic programs report spending more money than they bring in. If they suddenly have to start sharing revenue with the athletes, that might force some tough choices. Money-losing programs might have to accept going deeper in the red. Profitable ones might see their margins shrink, or they could come up with money by cutting other costs, such as coaches' salaries. But some schools will probably eliminate certain sports programs entirely, or replace them with versions that look more like optional extracurriculars and less like student jobs. At Dartmouth, for example, if the basketball players are employees, so too are the squash players, rowers, and field hockey players. With its $8 billion endowment, Dartmouth can probably afford to pay them all minimum wages. But it might prefer to get out of the niche sports business altogether. If the unionization of Dartmouth's men's basketball team led to a future in which star college athletes are fairly compensated, but in return, already privileged applicants no longer receive easy admissions or scholarships in exchange for playing an obscure sport few people care to watch, that might not be such a bad outcome. Hoskins and his teammates did not set out to change college sports. According to Hoskins, he and his teammates in the junior class came up with the idea of unionizing after seeing the student dining hall employees unionize, and the resulting rise in wages not just among the dining workers, but among all student workers on campus. The players are hoping the unionization effort follows a similar pattern, benefiting first them, then the rest of the Ivy League, then all college players. It's definitely not about bringing down the whole NCAA, Hoskins told me. It's more about change for the next generation of athletes. Our second article, A secret code may have been hiding in classical music for 200 years. By S.I. Rosenbaum. In the spring of 1825, Ludwig von Beethoven was struck by a gut ailment so severe that he thought he might die. That summer, after he recovered, he returned to the string quartet he had been writing before his illness, Quartet No. 15 in A minor, Opus 132, and added a new segment inspired by his survival. To this day, the piece is known for the slowly unfolding, baffled joy of its third movement, where the music seems to trace the shuffling steps of an invalid breathing fresh air for the first time in weeks. Beethoven would call it Heiliger Danksgesang, a holy song of thanksgiving. He wrote in the mornings when the light was good, on rag paper thick enough that he could scrape off mistakes with a knife. His handwriting was notoriously chaotic. He couldn't draw a set of parallel lines if his life depended on it. The maestro is said to have used his pencil not only to write with, but to also feel the vibrations of his piano, pressing one end of the wooden rod to the instrument while holding the other end between his teeth. He was by now profoundly deaf. In less than 2 years, he would be dead. Once he finished a composition, Beethoven would hand off the manuscript to a copyist who'd write it all out again, this time legibly. After Beethoven corrected any mistakes the copyist made, berating the man the whole time, the score would go to a publishing house where, after more last-minute changes from the composer, an engraver would trace it backward onto a copper sheet. From there, the score would be published and republished, appearing in largely the same form on music stands across the world, even to this day. But even discounting those final revisions, the Opus 132 that the world came to know was not exactly the Opus 132 that Beethoven handed to his copyist. The composer littered his original score with unusual markings that the copyist simply ignored. Below on staff, for example, Beethoven jotted FFMO, a tag that wasn't a standard part of musical notation and wasn't used by any other major composer. In another place, he drew an odd shape like an elongated diamond, also a non-standard notation. None of these marks made it to even the first clean copy, let alone the published version. Almost no one would see those marks in the roughly 200 years after Beethoven first scribbled them down. Then one evening in 2013, the violinist Nicholas Kitchen was in his New Mexico coaching a quartet through Opus 132. Kitchen is a man of obsessions. One of them is playing from the composer's original handwritten manuscripts rather than printed music, so he had a facsimile edition on hand. The errant FFMO caught the eye of the quartet's cellist. "What's this?" she asked. As soon as Kitchen saw Beethoven's mark, something in his brain shifted. Later, he would tell people that it was as if someone had turned over a deck of cards to reveal the hidden faces behind the plain backs. Suddenly, he had a new obsession. Over the next several years, he would come to believe he had discovered Beethoven's secret code. For most of the past two centuries, Beethoven's original handwritten manuscripts have been difficult, if not impossible, for musicians to access. Few could afford a trip to view them at the archives in Vienna or Berlin. Scholars hadn't bothered taking a look. By the time musicology arose as a discipline, Beethoven was seen as passé, said Lewis Lockwood, a Harvard professor emeritus and director of the Boston University Center for Beethoven Research. Kitchen is not a scholar, a boyish 57-year-old with a shock of bushy white hair. He's a working musician with a faculty member at New England Conservatory, where my parents also taught. The Boston classical music world is a small one. Almost everyone I interviewed for this story is friendly with my violinist mother and pianist father, and Kitchen is well known and well respected in those circles. Prior to reporting the story, I'd heard him perform with his quartet many times, though I didn't know him personally. That said, I was aware that Kitchen had a bit of a reputation as, if not an eccentric, at least an enthusiastic innovator. Around 2007, he persuaded the ensemble he co-founded, the Borromeo Quartet, to play from full scores instead of parts, because he felt it enriched the performance. Around the same time, the scans of Beethoven manuscripts began to appear on a wiki site for musicians called the International Music Score Library Project. The only thing better than playing from a full score, Kitchen believed, was playing from a handwritten original full score, the closest glimpse possible of the composer's working mind. Just by reading the manuscript, you are instantly exposed to an archaeology of ideas, Kitchen told me. You're tracing what was crossed out, an option tried and not used, one tried and refused, then brought back, all these processes that are instantly visible. The more Kitchen played directly from Beethoven's chaotic handwriting, the more anomalous notations he found. Initially, Kitchen didn't know what to make of them. My first thought was, well, it may be the equivalent of a doodle. Kitchen began to develop a theory about what he was seeing. The marks mostly seemed to concern intensity. Some appeared to indicate extra forcefulness. Beethoven used the standard F and FF for forte, loud, and fortissimo, very loud, but also sometimes wrote FFMO or triple F. He occasionally underlined the standard PPP or PP for piano and pianissimo for soft and very soft. Kitchen would eventually identify 23 degrees of dynamics, from FFF thunderous to PPP double underlined, a whisper. He found four kinds of staccato, two kinds of dynamic swells, marks to indicate different ways of grouping notes together, marks to reinforce crescendos and diminuendos. Taken together, Kitchen argued, these marks amount to living instructions from one virtuoso performer to another, an elaborate hidden language conveying a new level of expression, and thus emotion, in Beethoven's music that had been lost for centuries. Whenever people have tried to invent a way of writing music down, the solution has been imperfect. Jewish, Vedic, Buddhist, and Christian traditions all search for ways to keep sacred melodies from mutating over time. Each ended up with inventing a set of symbols for different musical phrases. Other cultures evolved away from notation. In classical Indian music, for example, every soloist performance is meant to be improvised and unrepeatable. In Europe, however, musical values began to emphasize not spontaneity, but polyphony, ever more complex harmony and counterpoint performed by ever larger ensembles. For these ensembles to play together, they needed some kind of visual graph to coordinate who plays what and when. The result evolved into the notation system in global use today, an extraordinary lossless information compression technology, unique in its capacity to precisely record even music that has never been played, only imagined. Orchestras in Beethoven's time, as well as now, needed only the score to play something remarkably similar to what the composer heard in their mind. It's as close as humans have come, perhaps, to telepathy. By Beethoven's time, composers had developed ways to communicate not just pitch, duration, and tempo, but the emotion they wanted their music to evoke. Dynamic markings like hairpins indicated when the music should swell and when it should ebb. A corpus of Italian words such as andante, dolce, and vivace became technical terms to guide the musician's performance. Someone like Beethoven, a man of extreme moods, might very well have chafed against these restraints. It's not a stretch to conclude, as Kitchen has, that Beethoven would feel the need to invent a method of more perfectly conveying how he intended his music to be played. But whether Kitchen is correct remains up for debate. Jeremy Yudkin, Lockwood's co-director of the Center for Beethoven Studies, also viewed Kitchen with skepticism. When I first talked to him, I thought he was nuts, Yudkin told me. But Kitchen's close and careful research won him over. He now believes that Kitchen has discovered a previously unknown layer of meaning in Beethoven's manuscripts. As to why the marks never made it to the composer's printed scores, Yudkin thinks Beethoven may have accepted that his large personal vocabulary of symbols and abbreviations wouldn't be easily deciphered by others. Perhaps, Yudkin suggested, he included the marks in his manuscript simply for his own satisfaction. When you put things in a diary, Yudkin said, because it yields a mental satisfaction, an emotional satisfaction, of being able to express what you feel. Over the past few years, Kitchen and the Borromeo Quartet have presented a series of Beethoven concerts, prefaced by brief lectures on his findings. But other than that, and his presentations at BU, he hasn't spent much time sharing his ideas with the world. Instead, he's been preparing his own set of Beethoven scores that will include all of the marks left out of earlier editions. As I was working on this story, I asked my father, the pianist, why he thought Western notation had developed to such specificity, even before Beethoven's time. He told me he thought it was because of the change in composers' perspective. Where before they'd been composing anonymously for the church, as music became more secular, composers' names became more prominent. They started to think about how people would play their work after their deaths. For Kitchen, that's precisely the point of studying Beethoven's markings. If written notation can encode music, he told me, music can encode human feelings. Therefore, written music can actually transplant a living emotion from one mind to another. It's not just telepathy. Music allows a sliver of immortality. At this point, Kitchen believes he knows the code well enough that he can hear it in music. Once at a concert in Hong Kong, he was listening to a performance of Beethoven's Piano Sonata No. 23 in F minor, Opus 57, the Appassionata. He noticed an unstable chord that seemed especially ominous and unsettling, the kind of quiet but emotionally powerful moment that Beethoven often noted with one of his bespoke abbreviations. I said, "I'll bet you that's a two-line pianissimo," Kitchen recalled. After the performance, he checked. Sure enough, scrawled below the disconcerting bass note troubling the otherwise serene chord, Beethoven had written a double-underlined PP. 200 years later, maybe Kitchen finally understood exactly what he meant. I'm afraid we've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.